From WABE in Atlanta, this is City Lights. I'm Lois Reitzes. Thanks for listening. This is our daily look at Atlanta's cultural life and the artists and creative minds behind it. Today, we'll be thinking about the different pieces that comprise a dramatic performance, either on film, television, or the stage. Contributor Scott Stewart joins us to discuss the music lending dramatic enhancement to this fall's TV offerings. We'll meet a company whose mission is to take theater outside of the theater. And first ahead, Hollywood and the Indies. Atlanta has them all. We've talked a lot about the film industry on City Lights, but today we're going to get an education on some of the nuances of the industry. We're looking at the difference between what people call ATL-wood or the big-time industry that created things like The Hunger Games and Guardians of the Galaxy versus independent or indie filmmaking. Joining us again is Linda Burns, a longtime Atlanta filmmaker and film educator. Welcome back.
Why, thank you for having me.
Linda, in terms of budget as well as philosophy, what distinguishes independent from Hollywood film?
I think everybody has a different answer in what they think. I think under $20 million, a lot of people kind of consider independent, but a lot of times that would be a studio producer who is doing something outside of the studio system. So perhaps they've done larger films for, you know, the Sonys and the Warner Brothers, but now they're doing something independent. I don't really feel like $20 million is an independent
film.
No,
it sounds like a hefty sum to me.
Oh, yeah. You know, really, to me, under a million, under $2 million, but really there's the $3 to $5 million indies, the two to three. So for me, they're still independent film. The definition of independent films is really something not made within the studio system. And I would include in that places like Netflix and Amazon now, and these different kinds of platforms that have all kinds of money behind them. So they may not be a studio, but they've got quite a few billion dollars to start creating
okay.
content.
So you would include those streaming services along with the studio?
Some of them, yes, that are the larger ones that have that big pocketbook, like an Amazon, like a Netflix.
What about Hulu?
And Hulu. You know, I think they also do smaller things as well, but I think they're really, they've got the pocketbook behind them. To me, an independent film is that kid who comes up with an idea, who either writes it himself, finds a writer, puts a team together, and either goes out and make their a movie with their friends with virtually no money, or they go out and they raise $1 million or $2 million, or maybe it's a producer who is living here in town who's been working on the big budget stuff as a coordinator or a production manager or a line producer, and then they want to go do something creative and unique, and they'll raise maybe three to five and pull in some Hollywood actors that they may have built relationships with on some of these Hollywood films that are in town. So I think the definition of independent is wide and varied, but I really like the true independent spirit where that kid just comes up with something and goes and grabs his friends and makes it.
Okay. What about one of the most exquisite films, I think, in recent years, Moonlight? Where does that fall?
I would absolutely call that an independent film. But again, it was some kids that went to FSU Film School that built some relationships and got some experience and got together and raised some money and created something exquisite. I would absolutely call that an independent film.
So even though it had a big name actor like Mahershala Ali, still indie.
Yes, I think in some respects, as an independent filmmaker, if you want someone to see your movie, it's helpful to have a star in that.
Yeah, and I wondered where something like Baby Driver, which everyone in Atlanta was so excited about because of the way it showcased Atlanta. We see names like Jamie Foxx and John Hamm, and you think, indie, but They must have worked for much less, I would think, than they
did. I don't think that was also a $2 or $3 million movie. They had some cash for that. But again, if you I think it was outside of the studio system.
Okay.
I mean, I honestly haven't looked at Baby Driver enough, but I know that I had enough people working on it, and I've seen the movie, and I know that was not a small budget movie. They may not have worked for the ridiculous amount they'd get paid on a $100 million
right.
movie. But that, you know, when you look at trying to get actors on some of these independent films, there's so many actors out there that are fantastic that we just kind of forget about because they're not getting the work in the marquee films, and they're interested in finding something meaty and exciting and that can give them that kind of comeback in their career or that little boost. None of those actors, I don't think John Hamm was looking for a boost in his career, but there's others that are.
Yeah, and then too, if the actors are so enthralled with the content and they don't need the money, they want to be a part of it.
And that's the key. It has to be something really, really interesting and unique. Your typical romantic comedy may not pull them in, but you really need to be creating content that is unique and different and that's going to give them an opportunity to do something that the Hollywood system won't. Maybe they're stuck in a rut where they're always the bad guy and they want to play the good guy, or vice versa. Or it's a female who's always played the cute sidekick but has never had a chance to play a deep emotional role. And I think those are the films that you have access to larger actors because they want to do something that is, again, outside of what the studio will kind of allow them, in a sense, to do.
Our producer, Gabby Watts, was talking about this with me before you came in, and she mentioned Swiss Army Knife and the Daniels. I mean, Daniel Radcliffe, does he ever need to work again for money? So he could do something.
He seems to do a lot of unique things, and I think that's... I mean, if I had all that money, I think I would go out and just keep throwing spaghetti at the wall and see what works, you know, to have fun.
Because you're Harry Potter and you could clean the wall with just, you know, just some magic. If you are just joining us, this is City Lights on WABE. I'm talking with filmmaker and educator Linda Burns. We'll be back in just a moment.
Support for WABE comes from Bark, helping to keep your children safer online by monitoring their text messaging, social media, and email accounts without infringing on their privacy. Learn more at bark.us. Bark. Monitor. Detect. Alert. And from the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra. On September 21st and 23rd, Paris comes to Atlanta as megastar Jean-Yves Thibaudet brings his piano pyrotechnics to the ASO's opening weekend. Tickets are on sale now at aso.org.
You're listening to City Lights on WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR. I'm Lois Reitzes, here with Linda Burns. Linda is a filmmaker and film educator here in Atlanta. Today we're talking about the difference between indie film and productions made by major film studios. So, Linda, let's think about these differences in terms of the set. What does an indie set look like versus a big budget film?
I'll start with a big budget film. And I'm looking at, you know, that $50 to $100 million film. You know, you're going to have hundreds of people on the crew. When you're looking at something like a Marvel film, because of all the, you know, you don't just have one camera crew. You might have 15 camera crews. You might have a camera crew that's only doing miniatures, like Ant-Man. There was a whole nother department that was just doing all the miniature work. So you may have a few hundred people. You're going to have a lot of very specific jobs. You know, I wear a lot of hats as an independent filmmaker. I may produce, line produce, production manage, be getting craft service, helping with wardrobe. I might find locations. I may do 10 different jobs on that set to help my little independent film. On a feature film, I might have 5 or 6 different working producers, simply because there's so much going on. So one may be more in charge of casting, one may be more nuts and bolts on the budgeting, one may be more focused on story, one may be more focused on effects and VFX work. So everybody's jobs are more specific and there's more people to do them. So you have hundreds of people. They're paid very well. They have really good food. They have trailers.
I love the way the caterers are always credited.
I
watch for that and I try to imagine. And then I imagine a lot of female Hollywood actors who probably are not partaking in those wonderful tables?
You know, they have a lot of really good salads.
Good.
And a lot of good vegan and low-calorie options. But yes, I mean, the care. My first job as a PA getting out of independent film and on a big-budget feature, it was like the freshman 10. I think I gained 15 pounds because you have this catering truck full of food. And then 3 hours later, they're rolling out like a honey-baked ham and some soup. And then it's lunchtime. And then 3 hours after lunchtime, they're rolling out, you know,
donuts.
Smoked turkey and don't. I mean, well, you have a food table all day long.
Oh, of course.
So there's craft services all day. Anything you could possibly want is pretty much there. And if it's not there, you can request it. On an independent film, your craft service table might have coffee, a jar of generic peanut butter, and, you know, I mean, a true independent where you have no money.
It sounds like public broadcasting.
Absolutely.
Except we don't necessarily have the peanut butter.
Yes. You know, there's less film crew. You might have 10, 15, 20, 25 film crew. You're probably, you may not have catered food. You may be, you know, taking out lunch from a local restaurant or having a friend, mother, who loves to cater, making you a lasagna. And you're wearing a lot of different hats. So you have a lot less people, and you're trying to, I may shoot 10 pages a day on an independent film in a 90-page script. I have to get it done in 10 days because I don't have money for all the equipment and the rentals and the locations. But a Marvel film might shoot a half a page of their script
right.
in a day.
Well, I'm thinking about something that wouldn't require special effects or a lot of complicated setups, actions like a Marvel film. But, say, a Woody Allen film. Scenery's not complicated. Often, I mean, is he one camera? Sometimes.
I would assume he probably has more than that now, but he's got a formula in some respects. You know, I mean, once you've been doing this a long time, you kind of get a formula, and I feel like I have that formula for independent films. I know what can be done at a certain level for very, very little. And there's kind of a formula after you've been doing it for a long time to understand you don't want to have a lot of company moves. In other words, I want to be able to shoot at WABE in this studio all day, and I don't want to have to move twice because every time I move, I got to pack up the circus,
right.
get on the highway, unpack the circus, and you lose 2 or 3 hours. Those bigger films, even though they're not complicated, can afford to do that. Independent films can't. So I think his style has been dictated over the years by his budget, and he has a formula where he kind of knows what he can do and what his sets are going to be and what his style and his voice is. And his voice and his style of filmmaking really works for a certain level of budget.
Indeed. If you're just joining us, this is City Lights, and I'm talking with filmmaker and educator Linda Burns. We'll be back in just a moment.
Support for WABE comes from the Alliance Theater, presenting Shakespeare in Love, a new play based on the Academy Award-winning film, on stage at the Conant Performing Arts Center now through September 24th. AllianceTheater.org/Shakespeare. And from Emory Executive Education at Emory's Goisweta Business School. Design thinking for business innovation can help business leaders shift the mindsets of their organizations to embrace creativity and business competency through the design thinking approach. Working professionals and executives that want to strengthen their leadership and strategy skills often take this 2-day short course, held October 11th and 12th of 2017. More info at worksmarter.org/NPR.
Back with City Lights on WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR. I'm Lois Reitzes here with filmmaker and film educator Linda Burns. We're talking about the nuances that distinguish indie from big budget commercial films. Let's talk about how indie films catch the eye of larger production and distribution companies. Actually, I'm a little confused about this, Linda, and I hope you can offer some clarification. We think of the big film studios like Universal or Paramount as risk-averse for the most part, churning out movies with lots of actions and superheroes sometimes. The criticism is that, you know, they focus group to death and it's really all about marketing and less about art.
But I can't disagree with any of that.
Try not to bash them. But sometimes there are indie style films associated with those larger studios, do they buy them for distribution, or do they say, okay, here's my charity case this year, I'm going to put a few million bucks or a few tens of millions of bucks toward this?
I think they do a little of each. I mean, I think sometimes, you know, there's this idea that you do one for them and then they do one for me. So maybe you go do this $100 million movie that you're not really that jazzed about, but is going to make the studio and yourself a lot of money as an actor or a producer. But you're working out that deal. I'm happy to do this. I'll scratch your back, but let me do this piece of art we've talked about for a while. I think that's some of it. And I think there's a lot of really great films out there that, you know, even though I think the studios are more about business than show, like in the beginning, I think there's still some people who do appreciate a good story and will champion those stories. But I think other ones are people that are producing things outside the studio system, maybe with a little studio help. And then those, they are getting picked up, or they're getting first look deals, you know. So there's, you know, there's filmmakers that used to live in town that are in LA now that have kind of first look deals with studios. So they might not be studio financed, and sometimes they are, but they may not be studio financed, but the studio is well aware of those pictures, and they probably have a first look deal. If this movie is as great as you tell me it's going to be, we're happy to pick it up. And if not, maybe it goes on the festival circuit, or they go to markets, or they do foreign sales. So I think there's a lot of different options out there.
So just in the little bit of time we have left, how can Atlanta and the state, how can Georgia get into a better situation, given we don't have the years of tradition and business development that LA has, but with the amount of filmmaking and TV that's done here, does that mean it's a better market for independence?
That's an interesting question. I think people forget we've had an industry for 40 years. Now, LA has been around obviously longer than 100, so, but we have had an industry here for 40 years, but we've always gone to LA to get our money or done things or found money locally. I think because the attention is here, that's certainly a good thing. I think there's a lot of people who are trying to elevate our content creation, and there's a lot more people that are creating content. A lot of people are moving here, and they might be moving here to work in other positions, but they're still creative artists, so they want to go off and make kind of art on the side. There's all kinds of people in town I've never heard of before that are doing independent films. You know, all of our independent filmmakers years ago, that whole class of kids are now professionals. Mm-hmm. And when the incentives came in, we swooped up another group of independent filmmakers who joined unions who are working on these big budget shows now, but they still are independent filmmakers at heart and want to go make things. There's other people who've been working in the production office and now they're doing films on the side when they have the time. So I think that as we train more people and they work on and have opportunities on these big budget features, they're learning about story, they're learning about the process, they're learning to make better content, and when they go off and make their own content, that will be better. One great thing that has happened recently, we have a new DeKalb Film, Music, and Digital Entertainment office, and they have partnered with Atlanta Film Society to sponsor some classes to educate those in DeKalb County. So if you're a DeKalb County resident, you can go to the Atlanta Film Society webpage and look at some of the classes. Some of them are introductory. Some of them are for vendors to learn how to be a vendor in the film industry, but they want to help educate DeKalb County residents on the opportunities out there. And I love stuff like that. I think that's very
great.
Exciting.
Yeah, so we've gone from state to city and now mm-hmm. to county level. Linda Burns is a longtime filmmaker and film instructor here in Atlanta. She teaches workshops throughout the year with the Atlanta Film Society. It's a pleasure, Linda. We learned so much when you visited. Thank you again for joining us.
And thank you for having me back. I enjoyed it as well.
Support for WABE comes from Nissan of Noonan. Nissan of Noonan, a fresh approach to the car buying experience. Their number is 844-FRESH-15. Online at nissanofnoonan.com.
Where will Amazon deliver 50,000 jobs? Cities and states all over North America are waving their flags, hoping to be the recipient.
Amazon should locate its second headquarters in Aurora, Colorado.
We are keenly interested in having Amazon in Georgia.
All of North Carolina is behind it.
I'm Elsa Chang. Cities compete to house Amazon's offices on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Every weekday afternoon from 4 to 6:30 here on 90.1 WABE.
This is City Lights on WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR. I'm Lois Reitzes. Found Stages is exactly what it sounds like. The roving theater company takes theater off the stage and into non-traditional spaces. This time, they're taking a play about women in tech into tech workplaces. I spoke with the show's playwright, Annie Harrison Elliott, actor Mary Russell, and Found Stage's co-founder Nicole Palmiero, who started our conversation with why it's important to have theater outside of the theater.
We're all professional theater artists, and we care very much about our craft and our art form. And we know that when we go see theater, we see the same audience members every time. And we want theater to be an event because plays aren't just competing amongst themselves anymore. They're competing with Netflix. It's just easier to stay home and to watch something from your couch. And we want to create something that feels like an event that builds a community around our plays and takes away some of the challenges to getting to a theater by coming to where people already are and meeting them where they're at. With our play Empty Rooms, we're coming to people's actual workplaces.
Yeah. Annie, you are the playwright.
Yes.
And I wondered, why did you want to write about the tech industry in particular?
Well, I started when I read Lean In by Sheryl Sandberg in around 2013. And I hadn't really thought about women in tech a whole lot, to be honest with you. I'm in the arts and it didn't really cross my path. But then when I started researching, I was amazed actually that the amount of women in tech has been decreasing over time.
Yeah, there were more in the 80s.
Yes, correct. And so I became fascinated with why that was. And once I started researching these women and their stories, I found it to be an increasingly important story to tell at this time.
Why has the number decreased?
Well, it's very complicated. Studies have shown actually that women really love their work and they love being programmers, but their workplaces are hostile environments. Women often face isolation, being the only woman in the room, lack of mentorship, lack of access to roles that innovate, the lead roles. So a lot of those play a factor, and there's even records of things like assault at these developers' conference.
So, you know, this touches upon something that's systemic, and you'd think, given as far as we've come, I'd like to think we've come some way with feminism, that this wouldn't be a problem, but it remains.
It does, and I think in a way it's deliberate, because if you think about how our future structure of our world is being built, it's now being built through programs, right? And behind computer screens. And who is building our future world? The answer is predominantly white men. So very few women, very few people of color.
You also found a connection between tech and theater in terms of representation. What was that?
Yes, well, there are actually very few female playwrights that get their plays produced, even fewer writers of color, and there are very few female directors currently being represented in theater. So the plight that these women face, it was familiar to us.
But no one is plotting against women playwrights,
well,
actors, directors.
I don't think they're plotting against us, but it is interesting. I think whoever gets to tell the stories of our time, those are the people that shape our history. And those are the people that are kind of shaping what we're experiencing now as a culture. So I think it matters who gets to tell the stories.
The play focuses on Jennifer, who has created an app that she's presenting at a conference the next day. We have a clip from your rehearsal where Jennifer's talking to a picture of Ada Lovelace. Let's listen.
You know what I've put into this, Ada. You've seen what I've given up spending all those nights alone. Coding, no dating, no social life, no love, no weird-looking children with my squash-shaped nose. Thank God I discovered you when I was 12. Who'd I have had to talk to all these years? You were barely more than a footnote in the book I was reading. Could have missed it entirely. I'm 40 now, and you're the one who's seen me through it all. It's a shame you were born in 1815. We would have made a great team in real life. As it stands now, you're the only other qualified woman in this office. You're the only other woman. Except, the intern, of course. She doesn't count. I'm sorry no one cared about your revolutionary paper when you were alive. People do care now. You know, I want you to know that they care about your genius. I called you the first computer programmer. I always cared about you. I want people to care. Is that ridiculous? I want them to care about my program. I've worked so hard.
What does this opening scene introduce to the audience about the tech industry?
So Jennifer is brilliant, and the program that she has created can really revolutionize society and the way that small businesses function. It's a data mining software that she created. And at the top of the play, we see her really enjoying her work and digging in and being herself. But there's also a loneliness there, and she's had to make up a friend. Ada Lovelace was the first computer programmer, and I think that Jennifer feels a kinship to Ada because they were both paving their own way. And Jennifer has had to struggle and prove herself, and she finally feels like she has something that is hers and to give to the world. But the only person who can really understand that struggle has been dead for a very long time. And we'll see in further scenes after this, this is the opening of all of the obstacles that come in just from within her own tech company and from her boss being very well-meaning and trying to help her by bringing in more people and bringing in Sarah, who is coming in from a hiatus after raising her children for several years. But the way he's doing it, he's not really asking her what she needs. He's just assuming, and he's pushing everything onto her, and it's taking her status away from her. It's taking her authority and ownership of her product, and the actual ownership, her name, her authorship gets questioned throughout the play.
The play also focuses on two other women, Sarah, who just joined the company you mentioned after taking a break to raise children, and their intern, Natalie. The dynamic among the women is very complicated, and at first it seems pretty hostile, too. Let's listen to this clip from your rehearsal where Sarah has brought cupcakes to the office after having to check on her kids. Jennifer's practicing her presentation for the conference, and Natalie, unfortunately, is caught in the middle.
Here, have a cupcake. You'll need fuel to get through the conference.
I don't want a cupcake.
I insist.
No, thank you.
I'm sorry they're not homemade. I usually bake from scratch, but no time for that anymore.
I don't require mothering.
Please, take one.
I don't want a cupcake. I don't need you to fix my code. I don't need help.
See, Natalie likes my cupcakes.
How do you know?
You like cupcakes, don't you?
Do you?
Everybody likes cupcakes. You like my cupcakes, right, Natalie?
Answer the question, do you like cupcakes?
Aardvark today. Do you have that information?
Fine. Thank you. My code is perfect. If anyone is looking for me, I'll be in the bathroom, working. You know, there was a time when the women's restroom was always empty.
What are the dynamics at play in this scene?
Well, it's interesting because I play Sarah, and I come in to check on Jennifer's work. But I have been away from the workforce raising kids, but we used to be childhood friends. So there's also that dynamic of coming in, realizing that we knew each other a long time ago, we were really good friends, and kind of building that relationship anew, because there is that competition. She's nervous about me coming in and replacing her or testing her product. And it's just this kind of power struggle of, you know, how much we support each other as women. We want each other to do well. We want to kind of instruct each other on, you know, how to survive in this world. But there's also that competition of, you know, wanting to be the best and, you know, wanting to be the smartest and, you know, having to compete against these guys and having them tell us what to do.
And maybe she's also envious that Sarah's a mother.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. I mean, I chose a certain path and she chose the opposite path. So that's what the play kind of deals with as well, is like the different paths that women have to kind of choose to conform to or kind of set in these boxes.
Are forced to.
Right, exactly. And I hope by the end of the play, there's the realization of like, you know, hopefully we don't have to choose and we can work together and create something even better.
And there are actually three generations of women in the play. There's a consultant that we meet about halfway through, and she comes in and she brings a sort of gravity to the play, teaching these women what she had to do to learn how to win the game. So through that, through the three different generations, we see how what these women learn gets passed on, that it's not creating a new system, it's learning how to win at the current system.
I think this is very clever. For this production, you are going into tech spaces around town, and each space is different. What do you bring with you, and how do you adapt the play to each location?
So it's a very unique challenge that we've set up for ourselves. Like I said before, we want our audience to be the people that can most connect to the story. So we knew that we needed to present the play in tech spaces. What we bring with us is basically just props and costumes. We use the existing lighting, sound system, projection equipment, furniture, and they're letting us rearrange things how we want and come in and really, we say that we're coming in and taking over the common rooms of tech offices across the city.
How have some of the people at the tech companies responded to the idea of your content?
Well, they think it's great. This is a topic right now that everybody is talking about, and their gender diversity is something that the tech industry is working to correct. And so I think we've gotten a very good response, in part because it's the right time to talk about it.
No one's been defensive or shooed you away?
No, actually. Everybody has been very excited about the concept of the play. The only no's we've gotten is that they don't have the space or the time. But all of the spaces that we've approached have been very encouraging, and we've met so many wonderful people just reaching out and trying to present this play all over the city. People who have, you know, given up their own time to connect us to other places. I was just at Strongbox West today and they signed up to do another performance.
Found Stages is very impressive, and I wish you all the best. Thank you for talking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with playwright Annie Harrison, Elliot actor Mary Russell, and Foundstage's co-founder Nicole Palmiero about their production, Empty Rooms. They'll perform Empty Rooms at locations around Atlanta, starting with General Assembly tomorrow evening. You'll be able to see all of that information on our website, wabe.org/citylights.
Support for WABE comes from Georgia Power. Today, there are a variety of ways to connect to Georgia Power. Get questions answered by phone, online chat, or on social media. Learn more at georgiapower.com/contact us. And from Capital One. You can open a Capital One savings account and discover more about Capital One savings online at CapitalOne.com/reimagineAtlanta. Capital One, welcome to Banking Reimagined.
This is City Lights on WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR. I'm Lois Reitzes. That's music from The Game Is On. The Game Is On from Sherlock. Last night, the 69th Annual Emmy Awards were held at the Microsoft Theater in L.A. with Stephen Colbert as host. The Emmys recognize the best in television programming, and television has a lot to celebrate right now. All of that drama and comedy has to be framed by music. So, with the Emmys and the fall 2017 TV rollout, there's a lot of exciting music coming online. WABE Film and Today Television, well, I'm going to call you music contributor. Let's call you media music contributor. That'll do it. That's encompassing. Our media music contributor, Dr. Scott Stewart, is in the studio to wrap up the Emmys and take a glimpse at the upcoming TV season. Scott, welcome back.
Hey, thanks, Lois. Great to be here. And I guess The Game Is On is the updated version of The Game Is Afoot from Sherlock. But what a fabulous series they have going on Netflix. It is an incredible time for television. I did manage to stay up without dozing to the end of the Emmys last night and learned that there are over 450 scripted television shows produced in this past season. And a lot of those are series, you know, that have 6, 9, 12 episodes. Pretty amazing. And even though 2017 audiences don't really stick to the same viewing habits as we have in the past few decades, the fall season still signifies that really popular time of year when TV networks roll out all of their new episodes and also their returning shows. Cable and streaming outlets continue to pepper their releases throughout the year, of course, but the Emmys capture a lot of that excitement as the 2017 TV season comes online. And as Linda mentioned in the segment right before us, that includes network, cable, streaming platforms. So Netflix, Amazon Prime Video, Hulu, even though a lot of us think of them as apps on our phones or televisions, these are multi-billion dollar entertainment platforms that are putting out wonderful amounts of programming throughout the year.
It really is fantastic. Scott, when Mel Brooks accepted the Tony Award for Best Musical for his producers a few years back, the first thank you he made was to Stephen Sondheim for not having show that year. I guess it's more than a few years back,
it seems
just yesterday, because I still think of and watch that video all the time. Similarly, Stephen Colbert mentioned in jest that all of the Emmy nominees should thank Game of Thrones since it wasn't eligible for any awards this year. What is that all about?
Well, yeah, that's right. It was just a little technicality. It was the first time since 2011 that Game of Thrones was not prominently featured in the Emmy nominations. But because the qualifications for being nominated hinge on episodes being aired between June 1 and May 31, Game of Thrones missed their window. They had a July 16th season 7 premiere here. The Game of Thrones soundtrack by Ramin Djawadi, of course, is wildly popular. I was lucky to attend Game of Thrones Live in the spring. My face is still warm from the shooting flames, but it's kind of fun to see these musical slash video slash live orchestra dancers, actors, kind of this new genre emerging that's coming out of music from these really popular
series. Were they
series.
Fully clothed?
Oh, yes. No spurting blood and beheadings. It was fairly tame.
I'm glad.
It was also interesting to note that the Emmy ballots this year were packed. Over 180 nomination submissions for Best Drama, and there were 140 for Best Actor, 113 submitted for Best Actress. So big numbers rolling in that really reflects the diversity and the volume being produced by television right now.
Which is great, but it makes it that much more difficult.
It's very challenging if you're voting, yeah.
Yeah. Scott, as you mentioned, American networks pride themselves on presenting a fresh slate of programming every fall, but it seems like there is security and stability in reboots, revivals, and spin-offs.
I think that's the case in so many of the arts. Even, you know, symphony orchestras will still put in Dvorak and Tchaikovsky and Beethoven, even while they're having some new music being played. Same thing with television. We look forward to these really interesting creative new programs like The Deuce on HBO and The Orville on Fox. TBS is bringing in The Last OG, but we're certainly seeing plenty of old wine in new bottles, if you will. So SWAT is back from the 70s, and Dynasty is back from the 80s, and we're even seeing Will and Grace come back from the 90s.
Yeah.
We have some spinoffs. I'm looking forward to Young Sheldon from Big Bang Theory and the newest Star Trek franchises out. This is Star Trek Discovery.
And we have more superheroes.
So many superheroes.
Can't have enough.
If your kitchen wall org chart is not filled out, you can add to it right now. There are four new Marvel Comics franchises coming this fall. That brings the total count of live action Marvel series to 11 on 5 different networks and streaming services. The Defenders just came out, and we'll watch this fall for The Punisher, Runaways, and Cloak and Dagger.
HBO's Westworld series tied with Saturday Night Live with the highest number of Emmy nominations, an amazing 22. It had already caught the attention of audiences and critics by being the most watched first season of an HBO original series.
That's right. It was a really kind of bizarre setting. Dystopia seems to be the theme of the day. Westworld is set in the Wild West-themed amusement park run by robots and visited by the socioeconomic elite for, oh, let's just say whatever they want. The show's official byline indicates that it explores a world in which every human appetite, no matter how noble or depraved, can be indulged. And so Ramin Djawadi, best known for his music to Game of Thrones, had previously worked with director Jonathan Nolan on Person of Interest, and he provides the soundtrack for Westworld. And because the show is this really interesting cross-section of this, you know, anachronistic Western setting, but it's run by androids far in the future, Djawadi composed this dark main theme, which I think has a slightly more modern vibe than Game of Thrones, but you can hear still some of the same musical gestures at work, and it seems to evoke some sort of warped theme park.
Spaghetti Western 2.0.
Meets Tron.
Yes. That was music of Ramin Djawadi from the acclaimed series on HBO created by Jonathan Nolan and Lisa Joy. The Handmaid's Tale, based on Margaret Atwood's literary classic, rocked the Emmys last night, and this was Hulu's first Emmy.
It was. More dystopia, right? This is a score by Adam Taylor, who is kind of an up-and-comer, but his music we've heard before in Osage County and Meadowland, a really foreboding score. It hits all of the right ups and downs, I think, for this movie. There are some really tense strings in the use of a drone, which makes us need and want to hear something, but sometimes that drone just drones. And there are lots of heavenly choruses, a la Alfred Newman, for some not-so-angelic scenes. There's a particularly creepy track called The Promenade of the Stolen Children. Strings that makes you clutch your gut. It's just so disturbing and perfect for this drama. Very gripping atmosphere of this entire very disturbing landscape.
Mm. Now, if you are just joining us, this is City Lights. I'm Lois Reitzes with Scott Stewart. We're talking about Emmys and television music, and we'll be back in just a moment.
Support for WABE comes from Windstorm Productions, presenting Wilco with guest Margaret Glaspie at the Fox Theater Sunday, October 8th. Tickets on sale now at foxtheater.org and the Fox Theater Ticket Office. And from Northside Hospital, offering clinical excellence across a full range of medical specialties, leading-edge technologies and treatments, and the personalized, compassionate care that you expect from Northside. Information at northside.com.
This is City Lights on WABE. I'm Lois Reitzes here with you and our media music maven, Scott Stewart.
Ooh, 3M.
3M and two S's. How much better does alliteration get? Okay, all of us in Atlanta were so excited about Stranger Things.
Yes.
Take it away.
This is the category Outstanding Original Main Title Theme Music. The Emmys actually have several more categories than the Oscars. There was a really interesting array of contestants, including Feud, which, by the way, is an awesome soundtrack, especially the opening title scene, Genius, The Good Fight, Victoria, and Westworld. Stranger Things, with a theme by Kyle Dixon, emerged victorious. This was released just over a year ago in July 2016 and has been really successful for Netflix. It received 18 nominations for last night's Emmys. The second season will be released coming up October 27th, and we understand that a third season has been announced by the Duffer Brothers. So the original music for this series, which is a cross of science fiction, horror, drama, maybe some other genres, is composed by Michael Stein and Kyle Dixon of the electronic band Survive. They received two Grammy nominations for this music, by the way. And the whole show, which is set in the fictional town of Hawkins, Indiana, which I think we can both verify does not exist.
No, never passed through.
It's like totally retro. And the whole main title is this edgy cover band music that pays tribute to 1980s hard rock.
Love it.
Just when you thought Stranger Things could not get stranger or more retro, Lakeshore Records, who produces the soundtrack, announced in June that they would be releasing the first season soundtrack of Stranger Things on cassette.
How very analog.
Which, yes, it's been very, very popular. Over 100,000 cassettes have been sold. I don't even have a cassette player anymore.
No. Listen, I have my video cassettes. I don't know what to do with anymore, but I won't bore you with that. Another great piece of music that gained proper recognition, I think, was the theme for House of Cards, Jeff Beals. Superb music.
Unbelievable artist. And up against some very strong soundtracks from Crown and Planet Earth 2, the new David Attenborough series, a series of unfortunate events, James Newton Howard. So again, we're seeing lots of crossover with film and television composers. This is in the category of outstanding music composition for a series. And so Jeff Beals been doing this now, and the specific episode for which he was nominated was Chapter 63, but we are all so familiar and have fallen in love with his main theme to House of Cards.
You want to talk about dystopia.
I do want to talk about dystopia, but I do always like to mention that for the most part, this soundtrack is recorded in Jeff Beals' lobby of his home, which
Isn't
I think is
amazing.
Very creative use of space.
And I think that music signals everything you could ever want to know about the series in much the way that a great opera overture
Very much
does.
So. Love it.
So on to Ken Burns.
Yes. The fall television series has some awesome premieres, and we haven't heard from Ken for a little while because he does these 18-hour documentaries, but he has the probably best known, I think, would be Civil War, that's often on PBS. He's been nominated for several Emmys. He won for Baseball in 94 and for the National Parks documentary. His latest endeavor is this 10-episode, 18-hour documentary about the Vietnam War. And this was just released last night during the Emmys, actually. And as you might expect, there's a large compilation of popular songs from the 60s that happened during the Vietnam War, and also some original music by Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross, both members of the band Nine Inch Nails.
I got a call from my manager who said Ken Burns and Lynn Novick have reached out about a new massive project they're working on about the Vietnam War, and we're wondering if you would like to be involved in composing it. And I just cut him off and said, for sure, we want to be involved in that.
So some really interesting stuff coming online here. Watch for Matt Quayle's period score to Feud, the Betty and Joan feud. I'm also a huge fan of James Newton Howard and Rupert Gregson's Williams' work in The Crown. And documentary fans will fawn over Jacob Shea and Yasha Kleb's soundtrack to Planet Earth 2. So much good viewing and so much creative and vibrant music for these television shows this fall.
Dr. Scott Stewart is WABE's media music maven and host of Strike Up the Band. He's on the music faculty at the Westminster Schools and the conductor of the Atlanta Youth Wind Symphony. Scott, thank you so much.
Thanks, Lois. My pleasure.
You have been listening to City Lights, and you can catch an encore broadcast tonight at 8. Tomorrow at 11. Park Krausen examines what haunts us with her Theater Emery production of Midnight Pillow, inspired by Frankenstein author Mary Shelley. Our producers are Aaron Wright, Gabby Watts, and Mike Johns. Kevin Rinker is our engineer. I'm Lois Reitzes. Thanks for joining us for City Lights and for listening to 90.1 WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR.